going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name is Andrea Rovensky. My pronouns are she, her. I guess I identify as an activist, I guess. I don't know. I also am a podcaster. My podcast is called Above It All, and I stream every single day. And normally I would cover, like, you know, usually U.S.-focused news and stuff. I would also cover protest coverage a lot. One of my bailiwicks is police brutality. I like, you know, whenever I see something about that, I try to shine a light on that. And but recently it's just been all about the protests in my city, because there was a police shooting like 5 minutes down the street from me. And so I've just been involved in that for like the last couple weeks. And, you know, I've been ignoring everything else, but I think, you know, it's worth it because other people can cover other things. This is where I'm at, so I should specialize on this, you know?
Take us through Elizabeth City. Just describe it for people. It's a town, from our understanding, of about 18,000, 20,000 people in North Carolina. If you can just describe it for us, like, what are the demographics like? Where is it located? You know, who runs the city? What's the terrain like?
Sure. Well, I've lived here for about 2 years now. So I'm not like, you know, the most, you know, historian of the bunch that could tell you info about it. But ever since I've moved here, I mean, it's a very, I guess, you know, it's a southern town. You know, the cops are not fans of just, you know, most people. They're really abusive. You know, they kind of have like this ego problem. And it's a small town, like you said. We've, you know, according to the census, I believe the last census, I don't know what the updated numbers would be, but according to the last one, it's about 18,000, maybe round up to 20,000 people here. It's by a very slim majority African-American town. As far as who runs the city council and the mayor are, you know, they're not the mayor is not the worst person in the whole world, but like, she's one of those kind of people. She's like, you know, a relatively elderly black woman. She's one of those people that tries to, like, you know, just keep like law and order. But like, you know, she's not a terrible person, but she's just very, very comfortable with power and just very out of touch. And that's what most of the city council feels like. A couple people from the city council have been marching with us, but for the most part, they just seem kind of out of touch with like what the rest of us are thinking and wanting and desiring. And we really, as far as my perspective is concerned, don't have that great representation when it comes to the local city government, especially when it comes to the police forces. There was a shooting here of Andrew Brown Jr. about 2 weeks ago, and that was by the sheriff's department of the county that we live in, which is Pasquotank County, North Carolina. And so the sheriffs decided to execute what they told us was a search warrant, and they kind of leapfrogged over the Elizabeth City Police Department, didn't tell them about it, and then ended up murdering someone. And so the sheriff's department is way more problematic than the Elizabeth City Police. But that being said, the Elizabeth City Police is also pretty problematic. But the sheriff's department is like, you know, these are, because it's a county, you know, position, and county elections are, you know, like, they've got much higher, like, you know, the way the state's gerrymandered, the county positions are heavily more Republican, heavily more racist than like the local city council and local positions of power in Elizabeth City specifically. And so we are in this position where we've got this like very overtly racist, very corrupt, kind of county leadership with this kind of like, you know, very anemic, like, you know, very, you know, just kind of absent leadership of the local city council, local government and stuff. And so it kind of just leaves us and the, you know, the community in this awkward position where, you know, we're being stonewalled by the county, and our city council isn't really doing much to help us outside of like the bare minimum. And so like we're in this like really weird kind of like power vacuum location where like, you know, we've got this curfew going on. And, you know, we've got this tape of the murder, and they keep trying to, like, you know, say someone else is responsible. So the mayor will say the sheriff's responsible. The sheriff will say the mayor's responsible. You know, like the SBI, State Bureau of Investigation, will say the sheriff should release the tape. The sheriff will then say, well, it's up to the state to let me release the tape. And they keep trying to bounce blame off of one another. We've got these corrupt judges. We've got corrupt district attorneys. It's like every worst case scenario that you can imagine with one of these situations is what we're dealing with here.
And I'm correct in assuming that the local leadership, the mayor and the city council, is largely Democratic.
Yeah, like, but it's like, you know, it's not like super activist, like Bernie Sanders style Democrats. You know, like we're talking about, you know, like just like kind of they're there to be there kind of people for the most part. But there's also like sizable Republican representation as well. Like for all of the emergency meetings that the city council has held, every single white city councilman has refused to show up for all of them. They've just boycotted every emergency session in relation to this police killing. And so like we're in this position where it's like, yeah, the obviously racist people are obviously racist. They don't give a flying, you know, F word. And then the people that are there to actually try to represent us aren't really that good at it. You know what I mean?
We'll talk about what we know so far about the police murder of Andrew Brown Jr.
So this happened, I believe, on April 21st. It's been quite a while already. And we've been protesting every single day, so days are a little blurry. But I believe it was April 21st at around 8 to 9 a.m., sheriffs originally said that they were executing a search warrant. They later claimed that it was an arrest warrant. So they, you know, the one of the other things here is that the sheriff's department has been changing the info, like changing details, you know, like saying this instead of that, like constantly, and every other day there's like new info that voids old info, right? So it's like, you know, purposefully hard to keep track of. But what we do know is there was footage released by the city council of a city camera that showed the sheriff's department coming in with a pickup truck, having, you know, like four or five people on the bed of the pickup truck with AR-15s driving into. Now, this is the shooting took place in a school zone. It took place like literally like down the street from an elementary school. And the shooting took place at around 8 or 9 a.m., which is, you know, a time where schools typically open. Now, we're still in this kind of like pandemic world where like, you know, we have virtual schooling and all that stuff. But either way, it's in broad daylight in a school zone. And so basically what they do is they find Andrew getting in his car, presumably driving somewhere, you know, and they claim that he's trying to escape from police, and they just start shooting at him instantly. And this is the part where from the video footage that's publicly released, we only see them driving up, and we can only like, you know, see like the car and like, you know, like some light, you know, gunfire, like you can't see any details from the city camera, but you can kind of see that there's action going on. And from what it seems like, and they also missed a lot. So they were shooting at Andrew's car. When he was killed, the last shot that killed him was to the back of the head through the car. But when he died, his hands were on the steering wheel. Presumably, he had no idea what was going on. We don't know exactly what's going on because they haven't released the footage. But if you drive up there and start shooting instantly, it's kind of hard to tell someone you're police. It's kind of hard to tell someone you're trying to execute a warrant, right? And either way, an arrest warrant, a search warrant, either way is not, you know, it's not worthy of deadly force. If Andrew was indeed trying to flee, which it probably wasn't, he was probably going to work. It was like 8:30 in the morning, right? So it's like, that's typically when people leave the house. But even if he was fleeing, well, okay, arrest him later. You don't need to start shooting in a school zone. So a bunch of stray bullets hit and went through neighboring houses. You know, there's multiple reports of bullets going through the walls in other people's houses, only being stopped like by a crock pot in the kitchen, like, you know, bullets from these AR-15s going through furniture in people's houses, right? So the police, not only did they shoot in a school zone, but they could have killed people. If someone were just walking through their living room, they could have gotten shot in the chest by a stray bullet. And so it's like one of those situations where not only did they massacre someone in broad daylight in a school zone, like, but they could have ended up killing significantly more people. You know, again, by the grace of God, the bullets just didn't hit people. But it's just, it just goes to show that the sheriff's department is extremely inept. And they've been trying to execute a very classic cover up of all the details. They're, you know, they release some names, not all the names of the people that were executing that warrant. And they've been just trying to be hush hush on as much information as they possibly could. Since we've been protesting every single day. And today, I'm actually, after this interview, going to go out. So today would be day 16 of the protests. And what we've been demanding is just to release the tape, release the footage. They keep saying that they can do it, and then they can't do it, and then they can only do it if they redact certain information. Then they say they can only do it if certain agencies sign off on it. And then it's like, just release the footage. And then once we release the footage, then we can be able to decide what exactly transpired. But until then, we just need to release the tape. And so that's what our demands have been. Very simple, is to release the tape of the killing, because we want to know what's going on, and we can't really rely on any of the information that is being given to us by the police. And we can only rely on what little information is being given to us by like other city cameras that caught the incident and public dispatch, like audio and stuff like that.
So it just, it seems strange, I think, maybe for people listening to this. I mean, obviously, it's not strange that they're trying to stop the video from coming out. Obviously, they don't want people to see it. But, you know, other cities obviously seem to have acquiesced to the pressure of tapes coming out, or it seems like maybe they've expedited that quickly to just get it over with. Why do you think that they're dragging their feet so much in this process? Is there any timeline at all to get the video out, or?
Yeah, I'll go into that. So a couple years ago, there was a police shooting in North Carolina. I don't remember the details because I didn't live here at the time. But after that police killing, they instituted the state legislature of North Carolina, which is heavily Republican. Now, we do have a Democratic governor, but, you know, that doesn't really mean much. But the Republican state legislature of North Carolina passed a bill that basically makes it significantly harder for body camera footage to be released. It makes it so that you have to go through like petitions and court filings and all that stuff. Basically, you know, saying that, yes, you can have the body camera footage be released, but it's so much work that most people won't like or can't have the resources to be able to do so. Right. And so it's just one of those very clear delay tactics that, yeah, no, it's technically possible to get the tape released. But, and so like right now in our timeline, I believe that the judge has said that there is a, right now, a 45-day window of deciding on whether or not the tape could or can't be released. That was instituted or initiated like, I think, a week ago. So I think we still have like 30-something days left before, like, you know, there's window of where the judge will then say, like, and I will say I'm not a legal expert. I don't know all the legal details and all the stuff. So I'm just going off of what I hear on the street and all that. So we're basically given 45 days to decide whether or not the tape can be released, like by like reading certain laws or how these laws can be interpreted. And so, like, you know, they're just trying to drag out the clock and get people to get tired, get people to go home, get people to give up. Because again, this is a relatively small town that has probably gotten away with like this kind of corruption since its inception, right? You know, like a southern town and, you know, a southern state, you know, with small town police departments. That's just a petri dish for corruption. And so they're still all playing by the same playbook. But at this point, you know, we're in like a position in American history where a lot of this kind of stuff, like police killing, just gets much more attention. People are way more primed to protest their government, way more primed to not want to give up, way more primed to not give up. And so we're in this position where we have these small town, like corrupt officials trying to like play by old playbooks, try to delay everything as much as possible with an increasingly energetic and increasingly angry crowd of protesters and residents here that just have a very simple demand, just release the footage. And so, and I want to be very clear that the law also states that the sheriff's department can release the footage if they so choose. And so, like, really, like, they're only – the law for this, like, weird, like, delay tactic thing that they're doing is just to, like, institute whether or not the people can force the sheriff to release the tape. I believe the sheriff can release the tape at any point. But again, the sheriff, his name is Tommy Wooten. He is a Republican, and he's not that great of a guy. I should actually also say that last year, when George Floyd was killed, we had a demonstration that Tommy Wooten came to, and I was, like, honestly a little disgusted that, you know, the local leadership that, you know, did the protest allowed him to speak, but they did. And Tommy Wooten got on a big soapbox and said, you know, we love Elizabeth City. Nothing like this will ever happen here. And if it does happen here, here's my personal phone number. And if you ever need anything, we'll be nothing but transparent. And so, again, as soon as Andrew Brown was murdered, everyone in Elizabeth City had the sheriff's phone number. He didn't answer the phone. He's refused to answer the phone. He's refused to speak to anyone outside of, like, a Facebook Live post. Since this whole thing has happened, he's only spoken to mainstream media and he's only done Facebook posts. He has not spoken to members of the community in any capacity. And so he's just trying to hide from people. Everyone knows he can release the tape. Even if he says he can't, everyone knows he can, because we're actually trying to educate ourselves. And again, at the end of the day, whether or not there's a law, well, it's not legal to murder someone. It's not legal to, like, kill someone while executing an arrest warrant. It's not legal to shoot in a school zone, right? So if whether or not releasing the tape is illegal, well, the law has already been violated. When you murdered Andrew Brown, the law was thrown out the window. So if you're going to tell me, right, law and order is such a huge deal when it comes to copying and pasting a video file, but when it comes to killing a father of seven children, all of a sudden law and order doesn't matter, I question that. I think that in my position, the law is just a suggestion. If you're going to go out there and kill someone, right, and the law is preventing you from taking accountability, guess what? If you want us to take you seriously, violate the law a second time and take accountability. Release the tape faster. Release the names faster. Who cares if you don't dot all your I's and cross the T's? Because guess what? If you're the sheriff, and you actually work with us, you might have a chance of being reelected. But at this point, the community is just so upset that I don't think it's possible that the sheriff, like, I would hope that the sheriff resigns, but he's probably not going to. But I don't think it's possible he's going to win another election at this point. But again, they're just hiding behind all the legal statutes they can, and they just hope people forget, and they're hoping people get tired. But we're over now 2 weeks. Like I said, today will be day 16 that we go out there. And so people aren't getting tired. The people that have already gotten tired have already gotten tired, and the people that have been coming out every single day are going to come out every single day. And so it's just a matter of time. We'll protest until the cows come home. And so, yeah.
Yo, my Uzi weigh a ton, son, carry it. Watch some body rhymes just to bury them. They throw some threat, but we scary ya. What you call privilege, we call them barriers.
My Uzi weigh a ton, son, carry it.
You fuck with the wrong generation. You fuck with the wrong generation. You fuck with the wrong generation. Yeah, you fuck with the wrong generation.
My Uzi weigh a ton, son, carry it. My Uzi weigh a ton, son, carry it. My Uzi weigh a ton, son, carry it. Ton, son, carry it. Ton, son, carry it. My Uzi weigh a ton, son, carry it. My Uzi weigh a ton, son, carry it. My Uzi weigh a ton, son, carry it. Ton, son, carry it. Ton, son, carry it.
Driving through traffic.
talk about the protests and the demonstrations. Just walk us through how they kicked off, and then let's start to talk about the response from the state locally in terms of just them clamping down.
So yeah, so like I was saying earlier, this shooting happened about a 5-minute walk from where I live, you know? So it's like when I heard about this on the news, what I did was I went down to the crime scene and went to go see what was going on. And so I spoke to a bunch of witnesses who said, yeah, like police just came up and shot someone. And, you know, like, and it was just ridiculous. And people were like, yeah, we're going to go protest. The city council is going to hold an emergency meeting or something. We're going to go protest and we're going to go make our voices heard. So what I do is I go home, I charge my phone, I get ready, I pack my bag and I go downtown. And I see, when I get there, there's probably a group of I want to say that Elizabeth City is a small town, right? Like I was saying earlier, like last year we had a small demonstration, when George Floyd was killed and probably only like 50 or 60 people showed up, maybe 100. Maybe, you know, but like it wasn't that many. And so when I first got to City Hall on the first day, there was probably like 20 people or so. But then, you know, over the course of people finding out what was going on, more and more people came. And eventually it looked at that about 100 people or so came. And so the city council basically didn't do anything and they didn't give us any information. And then, you know, the sheriff's department didn't give us any information. We had a simple request, just tell us what's going on. Y'all just came into our neighborhood and killed my neighbor, killed my brother, killed my dad, right? You know, like, what is going on? You got to tell us what's happening. And so, like, they kind of just, like, didn't give us any information from the jump. And so the first day, what we did was we basically just decided to shut down the whole city. We had, like, about 100 people, and we just marched down. Now, again, this is a small town, and there's, like, 2 or 3 main roads, right, where all the businesses are on. And so, like, we can just march down all the main roads and shut down all the chain restaurants, all, like, you know, the city government buildings. We can shut down. There's this big geographical point of interest in Elizabeth City, which is the Camden Bridge that goes through the nearby county. And the only way around that bridge, if we shut the bridge down, is a 30-minute detour, right? So, like, we have this position where we can just shut down that bridge, and it basically just shuts down the entire economy. For, you know, people that, you know, work in the city that live across the bridge and vice versa, right? So we basically just decide, all right, we're going to shut down the bridge. Okay, we're going to shut down all these major restaurants until we get an answer. And so, like, the first night was very passionate. And I also want to say that the protests the entire time, all 15 days so far, have been nonviolent and extremely peaceful, loud, very angry, but again, nonviolent and extremely peaceful. This is not like, you know, we've seen the local paper on the second day. The local paper called us an angry mob and tried to liken it to like Portland or something, which, you know, not no disrespect to Portland. I love them. Right. But it's like the style of protesting here is very nonviolent and very peaceful, but very loud. But all the, like, you know, the local media is trying to say that we're like Black Lives Matter terrorists or Antifa's like invading the town, you know, that kind of typical right wing garbage. When it's just the furthest away from the case. And so the first couple days were just like, you know, we're going to protest all day until, and we're going to shut down the entire city until the sheriff comes out and talks to us. And then after a couple days, it's clear the sheriff is not going to talk to us. It's clear the city council is not really going to do what we want. And so I believe they started instituting anti-protest measures around, I want to say, the 7th day of the protest. And then they institute. So I also want to say that we've been protesting at this point before the curfew was initiated. We had been protesting basically 2 p.m. to like 10 p.m. You know, like people would go out there when they get out of work. You know, for me, I don't have a day job. So I'd go out there, you know, we shut down and then we'd go home around dark time. You know, people want to get home and then you just come back tomorrow. So there's been really no overnight protesting. There's been really no, like, anything like that. People have just been going home. But again, people have been going home around 10, sometimes 11 p.m., right? So what they did was they decided to declare a state of emergency when the family was going to meet with a lawyer. And then they were given the 20 seconds of the tape that I mentioned earlier. And then at that point, that's where they did the whole state of emergency. Because you know how, like, the government does, like, oh, there's going to be something released. Well, obviously, everyone's going to break down and burn down the whole city. So we got to have a state of emergency. And then once they declared the state of emergency, they instituted an 8 p.m. curfew. Now, again, I just want to say, at this point, no even suggestion of violence. Everyone has been nonviolent. Everyone has been peaceful. Very loud, yes. Very angry, yes. Very passionate, yes. But peaceful. No property has been damaged. No people have been hurt. And, you know, people have been going home at around 10 to 11 and then decide to institute an 8 p.m. curfew and declare a state of emergency. And this is where things have started getting serious. Is they started busing in every single county in North Carolina. Every single one. Now, we are in northeastern North Carolina. We're on the tippy tip, northeastern North Carolina, by the water and by the Virginia borderline, right? So we have had people from southwestern North Carolina. We have had people from central North Carolina, not people, I mean cops, right? Bust in. We've had like these SWAT buses. We've had these RV mobile command units. We have actual like FBI. We've got like, again, every county in North Carolina, like local police forces in North Carolina. We have college campus security. We've got state troopers. So like every single police force that exists in the entire state of North Carolina, for the most part, is in Elizabeth City when the state of emergency and curfew is declared. And so the curfew is 8 p.m. for 3 nights. And then it changed to midnight, and then it was lifted, I believe, today or yesterday it was lifted. But for the 3 nights that the curfew is 8 p.m., things got very serious. People got hurt by police. Police threatened to use tear gas and pepper balls on, again, a peaceful crowd of about 15 people. So this isn't a situation where you've got like a standoff of like, you know, 300 protesters yelling at like, you know, 400 riot police. It was a situation where like 10 people were just like kind of sitting in the middle of the street peacefully chanting while riot police were like stepping on them and like, you know, handcuffing them with flex cuffs and like, you know, like attacking them and throwing them in the back of buses. And this is something that Elizabeth City has never seen before, like riot police, you know, like an entire full-scale military occupation. If I could tell a personal story, the third day, like the last day of the 8 p.m. curfew, they cracked down so hard that they had like school buses, right, like patrolling neighborhoods like upwards of like 9 blocks away from where the protest was. Because there was a point where the riot police on the third day of the curfew, and they were arresting people every single day, I should say. They threatened to arrest press. They threatened to use tear gas. Now, they never did. They never did use less lethal munitions, but they did point their guns at us. They also used they didn't use, but they pulled and pointed live weapons like pistols and handguns at protesters and across like, you know, corners, you know, like they were like preparing to shoot and kill people. So they did unholster and point live weapons at protesters as well, which is an extreme, you know, reaction to a group of 10 to 20 peaceful protesters. But on the third night, they had like, you know, again, they had like state troopers. They had all of these like hundreds and hundreds of different vehicles because during this night, while we were going to the protest, we stopped by a local armory, which is where they were storing all of their vehicles and all of their troops, essentially. And I got some video that I believe they were very upset with that showed that there were hundreds of these police vehicles pouring in and out of this armory that's kind of in like, you know, it's kind of not in downtown. It's on the other side of town, you know, so not many people go out there. And so and they you know, at night they just patrol and occupy the whole street. And so when I'm trying to walk home on the third night of the curfew, like I had cop cars like trying to like chase me down. I had to like hide in bushes. I had to like legit hide for my life from these police, because and other people were telling me this too. I was getting reports that they were like harassing, like not even just protesters, they were harassing people on their front porch for going out and just like just sitting on their front porch at like 9 p.m. like drinking beer or something, you know, which is something that people do at 9 p.m. right? Like they were just like harassing people in the whole like downtown Elizabeth City. and they were just trying to like harass protesters, pedestrians. The military occupation level is obscene. And so the state of, now the curfew changed after three nights to midnight, and no one has stayed at this point. No one has stayed past after midnight. No one has viewed it as worth it because like people need to go to sleep. Like, is it worth it to stay out and potentially get arrested or injured at like 1 a.m. in front of nobody? Cause like there's only three people there versus, you know, be out the next day, the whole day, and occupy the whole city. You know what I mean? So people just said it's not worth it once they change the curfew. But the state of emergency has stayed the same. And so we've had the police presence for all day throughout the protest. At 3 p.m., we've had this heavy police presence. We've had these SWAT buses. We've had these RV mobile command units. We've had like 40 police cars, right? Like, and it's just like they're all over the city at all times. Right. Like me, just like if I'm walking to the like where the protest is from my house, right, I will pass like probably 20 or 30 cop cars that are either driving around or parked in parking lots or like just all across the city. And again, this is a small city of about 20,000 people. And so we've got like, and I like to call them outside agitators, being bussed in from 200, 300 miles away. They don't live here. They don't know anybody here, and all they're doing is just attacking us. They're like, you know, following us. They're intimidating us. They're arresting us for no reason. And so the protests a couple days ago started getting out of hand again, because once the curfew was changed, and up until a couple days ago, there were no problems. People were just doing demonstrations. The police were agitating, but nothing like actually dangerous happened. But a couple days ago, they decided to try to say that we need to file permits now in order to protest, which is against the First Amendment to the Constitution. But, you know, but they also say, all right, you know, but we give you a 15-day grace period where you don't need permits, but people file permits anyway. And so, you know, the first day that the permits are required, we, you know, are told something in the morning. And then by the time it's like 4 p.m. when the protest is starting, they change the rules. They say, okay, now you can't stop. You have to like walk. Like the permit is only for walking. So if someone like stops to tie their shoe, they're liable for arrest, right? And so what we decide to do is we walk really slowly. And then police, like, you know, again, because we've got this position where it's like, you know, there's at the, someone can make a phone call and then there's 80 police cars, like, you know, just swarming. So there's like three or four police following us, and we decide to start walking really slowly through the major road where all the chain restaurants are on. And then the local police lieutenant says, you will be arrested if you're standing for impeding traffic or something. And then again, we're like, okay, we'll just walk really slowly. And then like, about 10 minutes later, a bunch of state troopers come, highway patrol, like all these other agencies, like, you know, all these different county police, and they come and they start arresting people. And they don't arrest people for walking slowly. They go out there and they pick who they perceive as leadership. So they start arresting people with megaphones. They start arresting people that, you know, they arrested the person who filed the permit, right? They started arresting people who they perceived as leaders to try to scare us and to break us up. And that didn't happen. And everyone was released the same day, and they were charged with impeding traffic. They were charged with impeding traffic. But again, the police are, like, according to the permit, which we did file. Now, again, I personally don't believe in filing permits, but the permit was filed, right? All the necessary paperwork was done. And because the permit was filed, they, you know, have a police escort in front and behind of protesters, right? So how is someone walking slowly any more impeding traffic than the police officers that are in front and behind of the protesters impeding traffic, right? So it's obviously just a nonsense charge. But then the next day, the police don't arrest anyone, but they threaten to arrest people constantly because we're walking too slow. And the police are just being very, very, very rude. And at the end of the next day, we had interactions where there were counter protesters. And again, we do live in the South, and about half of people voted for Donald Trump here. And to be honest, you know, I don't want to make any definitive statements, but if you vote for Donald Trump, chances are you're pro-police. And if you're pro-police, chances are you don't like protesters, right? So we've got a bunch of people that are counter-protesters harassing us. We had this guy who was driving drunk start, like, you know, using, you know, sexist slurs and start threatening us, start, like, shining lights in our faces and revving their car and trying to, like, drive into the sidewalk a little. And the lieutenant, the same lieutenant who threatened to arrest us for the last couple of days at this point, literally, and I'm not even joking, was there, walked up to the man's open window. And again, I was close enough because I was recording this and I was, you know, I was getting into there. I was close enough. I could smell the alcohol on this guy's breath. The lieutenant of the local Elizabeth City police decided to let that person go, did not arrest them. They were like, again, they were impeding traffic. People were trying to get home. So like people were literally in their car behind him trying to get home, like honking at him. So this person was literally impeding traffic, threatening protesters, right? You know, like harassing protesters. And the lieutenant to the police force here just let them go. And so this is the kind of, it just shows the clear, like, you know, two-faced nature of the policing. And the police are just continuing to agitate us. Now, starting yesterday, they said that we can only march on one side of the road. People have been driving on the other side of the road, honking at us, screaming racial slurs, that kind of stuff. And again, we've seen it protest all across the world that vehicle attacks are very common. All it takes is one person to make one bad decision, and we can have dozens of people be injured. And it's just a ridiculously ridiculous situation that we're going with. And the police are just trying to confine our protests, and they're just trying to see what we will let them do. And I can tell you that the people in the crowd, the protesters, the citizens of this the city are getting increasingly fed up with all these new rules. And so far, we're complying with the new rules. But, you know, there's a lot of people saying, you know, many people are saying, to borrow some certain particular person's phrase, many people are saying that we might just not follow the rules and start taking up the whole street again. And again, if the police want to arrest us for peacefully protesting, we got cameras, right? We have lawyers. And so we're at this point now where the protests are just becoming like a game of attrition between an overreaching state and a group of community and just family members, because Andrew did have an extensive family that have been marching with us at certain points who are just demanding a simple request to release the body camera footage. And again, we're just being met with a wide scale military crackdown, and it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I just hope that people really appreciate just the audacity of the state to put these different rules in place. I mean, from the curfew to the idea that people have to apply for a permit to demonstrate. I mean, obviously, like, groups like the ACLU have come out and condemned this as an attack on, you know, just basic, you know, civil liberties and the government's own rules. But it just shows, I mean, the way that the state will use, like, its own basic internal bureaucracy to try to stifle, you know, supposedly the freedoms that we all have. It's very clear what they're doing. And like you said, it's also interesting that they just play up this rhetoric of like outside rioters coming in to destroy the city, when in reality they're like flooding this town of like 18,000 people with hundreds of highly militarized and violent police designed to put down any sort of popular resistance to them killing somebody.
Yeah, it's a big problem. And this is the thing, is like at any point they could reinstitute an 8 p.m. curfew, and then the riot police could come out and they could tear gas us. They could do it tonight, right? They could do it tomorrow, because they first instituted the 8 p.m. curfew like on the day of, right? So it's like they could do anything they want at any time. And so it's just kind of like we're in this point where it's just psychological warfare, and they're just trying to wear us down. They're trying to make us tired. But I mean, I can tell you, I've been getting a pretty decent workout. I can tell you, I've got an increased amount of stamina from marching up and down the city every day for 16 days straight. And I can tell you that a lot of other people are too. So not only are we not getting tired, but we're getting stronger, and we're getting more and more stamina, and we're getting more and more tired of their nonsense. And that doesn't, you know, translate to physical tiredness, and that doesn't translate to going home. Even for the past few days, it's been raining, it's been storming, we've been having thunderstorms, and even still, we've still had 40 to 50 people out here marching, even when the rain is severe, even when there's lightning, even when there's, like, you know, all kinds of, like, weather effects. And it just goes to show that the crowd here in Elizabeth City, like the group here that's been showing up every day, is very serious. And we are very dedicated to getting justice for the family of Andrew Brown. Because again, this is our neighbor. And if my brother or mother or father was shot and killed by police, I would want my city to stand up for me. And so we have to take that you know, to heart here. This is our role. You know, like, the family is grieving. They lost a loved one, and we have to fight for their right to get justice. And that's what community solidarity is all about. And it just goes to show that the city council, the mayor, the local police, the county, like, officials, the judges, they are just so, so scared of a community that actually does appreciate solidarity that they're willing to break us up by any means necessary. And so far, they're running through the entire playbook, and I'm very interested to see what they'll come up with next.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at IGD_news. If you like and appreciate this podcast, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and give us a one-time donation. Sign up to donate monthly or donate through Bitcoin. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop to support. And now, back to the show.
And how have people reacted to this? I mean, this is a smaller town. But also people for the last year have been inundated with news of a massive rebellion across the United States. And now this has kind of come to their doorstep. What have you seen from just everyday people? Have people's perceptions of things changed? You know, what's the mood like on the street?
Well, I can tell you now, like, I personally, I am a police abolitionist. I don't like police at all. And that's been my stance for a while. But not everyone in a small town like Elizabeth City is going to agree with that, right? So, like, for the first couple days, there were a lot of people that maybe necessarily weren't pro-police, but were like, okay, maybe there's good cops, right? Like, you know, like, that kind of stuff. Like, maybe they'll help us. Maybe the city council will help us, right? And, but, you know, they've just been proven wrong at every juncture. And so, like, you know, like, when they instituted the curfew and they brought the riot police out, everyone who was out there for every day before that who was saying, like, you know, there's some good cops, or, like, maybe they'll do something, it's radicalized a lot of people. At this point, anyone who's consistently seeing what's happening in Elizabeth City that lives here is becoming anti-police by the, like, more and more against policing by the day. Just seeing the kind of nonsense that they're doing. We had yesterday where we have, like, friendly cars, like, behind us, like, they have, like, you know, water and food in case, you know, someone has, like, you know, someone is thirsty or has, like, you know, passes out, because it is hot here in the South, right? So we have people, like, in a truck behind us with water and food. The police keep trying to cut them off, keep trying to separate, you know, them from us, right? And people are just getting very, 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 like, a clear view of policing in America. And so, the you know, everyone out there on the street who was, like, on day one may be like, okay, well, the local police isn't that bad, or, you know, maybe there's some good cops. That kind of rhetoric has almost entirely died down. We're, you know, at this point, everyone's in agreement that, you know, the local police is not our friend. There might hypothetically be, like, theoretically, possibly, in, like, a fantasy world that isn't the world that we live in, be a good cop. But most people are not out here saying that there's good cops anymore. And it's actually one of the things is, like, we've been having a lot more, like, you know, relatively anti-police chants and slogans in our protesting. And now, like, the sheriff's department is trying to paint us as, like, an anti-police, like, militant mob or something. And it's just ridiculous. Like, if we, like, if the, like, the people of Elizabeth City were mostly amenable, if the police were to have responded, like, you know, in any capacity, in a reasonable nature, you know, people of Elizabeth City could have been, like, pro-police. They could have actually been told, oh, wow, the police actually helped us for once. But they've been proven wrong every single moment. And, again, it's radicalizing a lot of people. I've spoken to a lot of people that on day one, you know, wouldn't have said the police, but on day 16 are saying the police. You know what I mean? So it's definitely radicalizing a lot of people. And in my opinion, that's a good thing. I think people really need to see what's going on in this country, and they need to stop having these rose-tinted, like, point of view, like this, you know, TV show, like, movie kind of, like, point of view of how policing is, because police are not our friends. They're our enemies every step of the way. They killed our neighbor, and they're going to try to, like, arrest us and hurt us and attack us and intimidate us by any means that they can. Like, there's no good cop, like, plain and simple. If there was a good cop in Elizabeth City, we would have seen him by now. It's been 16 days. Where are you at? And most people are thinking the same thing I am.
Well, where do you think things go from here? Obviously, things are going to continue. This is a volatile situation. Definitely encourage people to watch your stream and check out your stuff on Twitter. I'm just curious, you know, where do you think things are going to go in the coming days? It just seems kind of so up in the air.
Well, yeah. So like I was saying, they gave us this 45-day like window or something, you know, like an obscenely long amount of time to try to get us to get tired, make us be tired. But I can tell you right now, like maybe a week ago we were tired, but now we're emboldened. We're organizing. We're, you know, like, you know, right, like getting all of each other's contact information. We're like, you know, getting groups. We're having like, we're, you know, we have people training and like, you know, medic, you know, kind of stuff. Like people are like, you know, we have some nurses that are joining us, more. We have people that are like taking the protesting itself very seriously. And so like we're getting more well prepared, for potential action, because we think, my personal, like, you know, speculation is that once the media goes away, and the media has been disappearing for the last couple of days. We've had less and less media here. And that's why I've been trying to cover this protest with my podcast and everything as much as I can. Because, you know, once the media is gone, you know, the police might think, okay, now we can strike. You know, once all the cameras are gone, the police might think, okay, well, now no one's looking. And so I feel like if more and more mainstream media start to leave, which they have been, then it's totally possible that they reinstitute the curfew. It's possible they make like a 6 p.m. curfew or like a 4 p.m. curfew. It's possible that they just have riot police occupying the streets full time, like, you know, all throughout the day. Anything like that is possible. Given what I've seen so far, that would not be out of the question, that they would just like pull it back sooner and sooner. Because according to the city manager for the budget, we have been costing the city anywhere between $5,000 and $25,000 a day with our protesting, in terms of like shutting down the bridge, you know, like causing economic impact to local businesses, you know, like making it so that people that work for the city can't get to work or can't get home in certain ways. So we've been causing a significant economic impact on the city, and they are feeling that impact, and they are going to get progressively and progressively more and more upset at that. And so I feel like they're going to bring out any tactics that they could in the coming weeks, especially if the cameras start to go away. And that's why, again, I've been trying to dedicate every single day of my show for the last 2 weeks and for the next as many weeks as this lasts to showcasing what's happening. Because as long as there's some documentation, you know, it prevents the police and from state officials from like manufacturing a narrative, right? Because if I can go out there and attend every single protest all day and see that there's no violence and it's all documented that there's no violence, right? Then it's a lot harder for the police to say, oh, well, someone did this and therefore now we have to go start arresting everyone. You know what I mean? And so, but I feel like they will at some point. I feel like they are going to get more tired more quickly than we will, because at the end of the day, they're the ones losing the money. They're the ones that are having to be bussed in and can't go home, right? They're the ones that are, you know, have been training for years and years, if not decades and decades, for this moment. This is like their radicalizing moment of like, oh, I get to bust some heads, you know, right? That's how police really think. And so, like, I feel like they're going to get more and more violent. They've been getting more and more violent, and it's been consistently getting more and more violent. And so I feel like that's just going to happen. And I'm very fearful that people are going to get hurt. And so that's why we are trying to train each other in more advanced protesting, you know, techniques, or trying to get more and more medics out here, more and more legal assistance, and just getting more and more organized. Like, everyone needs to know each other's name. Everyone, you know, needs to know like who we are, and like, you know, everyone needs to like know each other better so that we can protect each other. And it's just that simple, because the police aren't going to protect us. And so, yeah.
Is that something that you're seeing happen in the town? Like, are people forming new relationships to before?
Absolutely. Like, I mean, I can tell you, like, I, you know, have met a bunch of people at these protests that are really cool and really chill. And, you know, we've been hanging out, like, you know, before or after protests, you know, we've been hanging out. And, you know, like, that's kind of what we've been doing. We had one day where the sheriff's department blocked off their parking lot to try to prevent us from meeting there. And so what we decided to do was host a cookout and someone brought like a grill and everyone just like chilled there for like 10 hours in the parking lot. And so like that was a good opportunity to meet new people, you know, where like we're all just getting to know each other for the first time in a lot of capacities. And so people are like, it's really bringing the community together in a beautiful way. That again, with, you know, these circumstances are tragic, but I think the result is something that can grow into something that will change the city forever, I think.
That's interesting you brought up the cookout thing. I think this is something that a lot of people have been talking about, that in a lot of the instances of cities that have seen these cycles of struggles and rebellion, it seems like everything hits a point where you just can't keep going out into the streets all the time, or you know, your people are starting to go home and you kind of need to switch things up. What's the nearest like big city that people could like come from and support? Is it, how far away is it?
Oh, well, the nearest like big city, I guess, would be like the Virginia Beach area, which is about 45 to an hour away. But we've had people like North Carolina specifically, we've had people come from Raleigh, you know, Greenville, Durham, Charlotte, like all that kind of stuff. Like, you know, almost like we've had people like come out from a lot of major cities to like provide support, to like give us resources, like give us like supplies, like water, legal assistance. But yeah, I guess the closest city would be like the Virginia Beach area.
It looks like a beautiful area on the map. It looks like it's, you're kind of like in a, how would you describe it? An inlet by the ocean almost?
Yeah, yeah. It is super nice. Like, we've been meeting at we have a waterfront park, right on this, on the river. And so we've been meeting there, you know, for a while. And it's like, you know, we get this nice ocean breeze, and it really is just kind of like a beautiful area for sure.
Is that something that people on the ground are actively asking for, is for people to come in and show solidarity?
Yeah, for sure. Really, our kind of thing is like anyone is allowed in our movement. It doesn't matter. Like, we've had people come from like Pennsylvania as well. Like, you know, anyone's allowed in our movement as long as you don't, you know, start anything, and as long as you defer like to our local leadership, right? You know, so we don't want people coming in and making their own decisions and getting us in trouble, right? So as long as you're coming in, as long as you're like 100% absolutely dead set on listening to local leadership, we're fine with all the support that you would love to provide, for sure.
Well, just in closing, like, are there ways that people can either donate online? I don't know if there are people that need to get bailed out, or if there's just different groups that are fundraising for supplies or whatever. And also, if you want to talk about how people can check out your work and your coverage.
Yeah, so we do have bail funds that are supporting us, and they are like relatively well funded. If you did want to provide supplies, we are working on getting like actual, like, you know, organized like group stuff that, like, you know, so it's not just like you're sending like me money on Cash App to buy someone else water, you know, but like, you know, we're trying to still work on that. When it comes to getting outside funding, you know, a lot of people are just, you know, not, you know, the most technically literate, I guess. And so it's taken us a little bit, but we're getting that set up. And so, like, you know, I can potentially forward this to you later if you want. But as far as, you know, any support, really, just share what's going on. Like, that's like the really the biggest thing that we want, is because this story has been kind of like, you know, the local, like, you know, all the local officials are trying to cover it up. Mainstream media has talked about it a little bit, but like, really, we just want people to share what's going on. We want people to share the police reactions. We want people to share like the story of Andrew Brown and how he was murdered by the police. And really, that's the biggest thing that you could do, is if you could just forward this interview or the show to someone else, or, you know, like, you know, share like a stream of, you know, to someone else. Really, that's the biggest thing that you could probably do to help us. And as far as following my stuff, you can just follow my show. I try to do like extensive recaps on my podcast called Above It All. So you can just like search Andrew Brown Above It All, and you'll find all of my recaps on there. And I try to have them organized like that.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.